online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Multinational dairy processor Lactalis has confirmed it will close its factory at Echuca on the Victorian New South Wales border.
Devastated on behalf of all those that work there, devastated on behalf of the community. And the question I'll have for the CEO when I talk to him next week will be, why didn't you invest that money in Echuca? Why invest in Bendigo?
And the bureaucracy holding back the growth of farm stays and other agritourism ventures.
A lot of the operators that we work with are experiencing a really difficult pathway that can take an extended period of time and a lot of money just to get to a point where they can open the door.
We'll also look at a record harvest of corn. You'll be surprised what a big deal it is. And of course, Richard Bailey with the Livestock Report. But first, we're going to talk to the supermarkets. And this is something you might like to have a little say on. So if so, send me a text on 0438 922 936. 0438 922 936. And the federal government has flagged big fines for supermarkets if they engage in anti-competitive behaviour. An interim review of the Grocer's Code of Conduct has also suggested fines of up to 10% of annual revenue for supermarket corporations which mistreat suppliers, which could mean millions of dollars in fines. Nathan Richardson is a farmer and chair of the Tas Farmers Vegetable Council. He joins me on the line now. Good afternoon, Richard.
Afternoon, Fiona.
Now, tell me, what are your thoughts? Big fines, the threat of big fines for supermarkets to behave. Do you think that's enough?
I don't think the 10% is near enough. These are massive companies posting tens of billions of profits, and in percentage terms, much smaller family farms and warehouses could face bigger fines for industrial relation breaches, or if we cut down the wrong tree or something else, we would have a fine in our business much larger than 10%. So probably 20 or 30% would be better.
That'd send a real message.
Well, it would, but ultimately, I mean, who pays the fine in a corporate? It's not the board of directors. It just comes out of probably ultimately, the goods that they sell, and they'll find a way around it. And where does that fine money go? Does it go to the suppliers or just into government coffers? But there's a lot of unanswered aspects to this inquiry, for sure.
Well, another thing that the interim report says is to make the code of conduct compulsory. I mean, that must surely, probably should have been like that according to farmers.
Yeah, look, I'd have a question for Mr. Albanese and Mr. Emerson, is this just a simple case of deleting the word voluntary and replacing it with mandatory, and it's just business as usual and we get on with our day? Or is the industry going to be bogged down with political and legal jousting for the next 10 years to develop this code and the laws and the fines and the rules around it? That's a major black hole in this coverage so far.
Because I suppose if, and you probably know of suppliers that have been mistreated, it's still a David and Goliath sort of situation, I suppose.
They're massive corporations. Their web entangles nearly 80 cents in every retail dollar spent in Australia. And, it's they cover international business as well. They have, a lot of people and resources at their disposal to, work around things. And, it's going to be really tough for this to have any meaningful effect back to the farm gate.
Have you, as a chair of the Tasmanian Veggie Council, have you sort of come across farmers that have been in despair, having maybe had their veggies knocked back or something by one of the big supermarkets?
Oh, on an annual basis, on a monthly basis, on a multi-decade basis. Whether it's a leak is a couple of mils too big in diameter, or an apple has a green blemish on it when it should be all red, or a carrot slightly bent that gets discarded, it's just nonsense. And what these corporations do, the supermarkets, is they actively encourage oversupply in Australia, which forces the price down to the farmer, and ultimately it grows their margin. And it's going to be real tough.
Well, there's this, it sounds like when you're talking about carrot and stick sort of situation, it sounds like the government's looking at a fair bit of stick, but, you know, whether that makes any difference is what you're saying.
Well, I would expect that the same rules apply to the producer as what does to the retailer. And, you know, one area that I would like, one question that I would like answered is that, you know, in this supply and demand type market that we have, if it's seen that a producer is profiting quite well from tight supply and good demand, does that give the supermarkets the equal avenue to say that the farmer's now charging too much and they're not equitable in their pricing? So sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for, and this can't just be a one-way street at all. I'm sure there's going to be two-way traffic in this one.
And you talk about a bit of an imbalance of power. It sounds like you're reluctant to take on any more rules and regulations, you know, in terms of whether it be for the supermarket or for the farmer.
Well, like I said, these corporations can employ people on million-dollar salaries to implement policies and laws that they have to do. And you know, if this or when you know if this becomes mandatory and it becomes law, then what implications does that have on your smaller type operation, your mum and dad producer, and your smaller pack house and your processors? You know, this is where it's not being explained. It's too simplistic to complain about what it's costing us to fill our grocery basket at the moment. I mean, these corporations deserve everything they get, really. They've acted with the sole purpose of greed, and they are only 100% responsible to their shareholder, and their revenue needs to grow year on year, their profit needs to grow year on year, the return to the shareholder needs to grow year on year. And they just keep consuming enterprises. They are involved in the meat market, the milk, the berries, the vegetables, fresh and frozen. They're involved in fuel.
Well, Nathan Richardson, what would you, you know, as a farmer representative, what do you think farmers need from this review?
Well, we definitely need this code to be strengthened for sure. That's it's got to happen. There are... We've had the inquiries that have been around all around the country now, and they have heard loud and clear the appalling behaviour of these retail outlets back to the producer and the smaller and large processors. And it's not good enough. It's terrible behaviour. And I think Mr. Albanese needs to do whatever this report recommends, and ultimately... Mr. Albanese could look at some of the things that he's been the architect of in the last 12 or 18 months in the abolishment of the peace rate and the enterprise bargaining agreements that we've had around Australia and the rise in the minimum rate of pay and just other onerous industrial relation laws that are impacting business.
All right, Nathan Richardson, farmer and chair of the Tasmanian Farmers Vegetable Council. Thanks so much for joining the Country Hour.
No problem.
AFL have put out new
Rick Goddard
concussion protocols. How will clubs practically put them into place? Ben Harrison is an AFL and cricket coach.
You can measure what the process is to recover from a cork thigh, but brain trauma is a completely different thing, and it does stop with the coach. The importance of that with the coach is that they take notice of what the medical staff available to them provide as far as advice is concerned.
Rick Goddard, Monday to Friday from 5:30 a.m. on ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Multinational dairy processor Lactalis has confirmed that it will close its factory at Echuca on the Victorian-New South Wales border. Warwick Long has the report.
Lactalis, which produces Paul's and Oak milk and Lemnos cheese, amongst a wide range of products found on supermarket shelves, had two factories in northern Victoria, and it has just picked one to survive and invest in, whilst it will shut the other by the end of the year. The Bendigo factory is the winner and will receive an $85 million upgrade and the promise of new jobs, but the company is not saying how many. The Echuca factory and its 74-strong workforce in traditional dairy heartland of northern Victoria is the loser. No one from the company is talking to the media today. They did send a statement voiced by a reporter which says,
"The closure could impact approximately 74 employees and contractors. A long-term plan to meet future growth aspirations was made after a detailed review of our yogurt and desserts division. The plan sees us have one regional hub in Victoria that is fully utilised. Our selection of which site considered milk processing capability, operating costs and site layouts. We are now consulting with our Echuca team about these decisions, including how best to support them through the implementation. I am committed to genuinely listening to our team and considering their input as we work through this. This is not a decision we take lightly. For some employees, there will be opportunities for redeployment to other Lactalis sites, and those opportunities will form part of the discussions with individual employees."
The ABC has contacted the main union on the Echuca site, the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union, and has not heard back. We have also contacted Campaspe Shire Council, and so far, it has not returned our calls. The local Member of Parliament, Peter Walsh, the member for Murray Plains, is also the leader of the Nationals in Victoria. He received information last night from Lactalis that the Echuca factory was to go. To say he's disappointed puts it mildly.
Well, so I got an email about last night, Warwick, informing me after they'd been to talk to the staff there, saying that obviously, as you said, they were going to close down Echuca and they're going to invest more money into Bendigo and into the supply chain and the manufacturing of their yogurts and dessert business. Devastated. On behalf of all those that work there, devastated on behalf of the community. And the question I'll have for the CEO when I talk to him next week will be, why didn't you invest that money in Echuca? Why invest in Bendigo? They've had a strong presence in Echuca for a long time. Great place, as I understand it. Got a very loyal workforce there. Why didn't they invest in Echuca?
And do you know if the workforce, or indeed yourself as a local member, did you see this coming?
Not at all. No, not at all until I got the email last night. And I suppose if nothing else, at least they sent me an email. Quite often as a Member of Parliament, you hear about these things when it hits the media. So not that helps anyone that's going to potentially lose their job. But as the email says, there will be the opportunity for some of the 74 staff that are going to be affected to take up opportunities at other plants.
Do you think many of the 74 staff would want to move from Echuca to Bendigo to work?
I've got no idea, Warwick. This is like, you know, 15 hours after I became aware of it. The staff became aware of it yesterday, so it's still very raw for them because no doubt it was an absolute bolt out of the blue for them as well that no one would have seen it coming.
What does it do for Echuca? That factory, as you say, has been there for a long period of time. It's on the edge of Echuca, sort of as you're driving out of town to the east. It's been an important part of the industrial area of Echuca as well, and I'd imagine an important part of providing a stable workforce for a town like Echuca that isn't, you know, in the tourism industry. This is separate to that. What does it mean to lose that?
Well, it means a 74 jobs, 74 families, people that are impacted by this. So the first thoughts are always for those who are personally impacted. But that food manufacturing precinct has been there for a long time. It was one of the reasons to get gas to Echuca years ago for the food manufacturing sector there. So it just will leave a huge hole down that road.
Does it show sort of wider issues with the dairy industry in northern Victoria at the moment? Looking around, sort of close by areas of northern Victoria, you've had difficulties. Leechville no longer has a dairy factory. Rochester no longer has a dairy factory. Now Echuca is about to lose its factory. Does that show sort of a change in dairy in northern Victoria?
Well, I don't know if that's the reason for this, Warwick. There is a bigger issue, most definitely, as you've talked about with milk, the drop in milk supply. But they're saying they're going to invest $85 million over the next 3 years to enhance their manufacturing and supply chain, but most of that money is going to go into Bendigo. So I think it is slightly different to the Leechville and the Rochester story that you talked about, which in largely was driven by a lack of supply of milk and the competitive nature of dairy manufacturing, particularly milk powder.
The CEO says he'll be in town next week. What are you going to be looking for as far as information from the Lactalis CEO?
Well, the first question I'll be asking, as I said at the start of this interview, is why Bendigo? Why not Echuca? Why not upgrade what's in Echuca? Because as I understand it, very loyal workforce, and they've been there a long time.
The ABC understands CEO of Lactalis, Mal Castledine, will be in Echuca early next week to meet with workers and affected staff and talk about a plan forward. So far, he has declined the opportunity for an interview.
Warwick Long with that report. Now, animal health authorities are updating global bird flu control strategies, a task made more urgent with the recent outbreak of bird flu among dairy herds in the United States. Poultry health and avian influenza expert Robin Alters says this alarming spread should prompt new thinking about how food systems are managed.
Highly pathogenic avian influenza H5N1. It's not new to us. It caused great global concern in the early 2000s when we had the very widespread outbreak in domestic chickens in particular. And really what has happened since that time is that the virus hasn't gone away. Viruses keep changing until they find a way to evolve into new and niches that are favourable for them. And that is what has happened with H5N1. It's now been diagnosed as causing illness in dairy cattle, initially in two states in the US, Kansas and Texas, but now indications that it has spread to other herds. But what they're finding in the US is that some of the cattle that have been transferred from those infected herds have turned up positive in other states. So there is now a concern that the virus is being transmitted by the cattle rather than via another host.
And what impact has this strain of bird flu had on those dairy herds in the United States? Has it affected, for example, milk production?
Well, certainly one of the indications that they had was ill thrift in the animals with lowered milk production. As with dairy production here in Australia, when you get signs of an unhealthy cow, that milk is withdrawn. So then certainly the producers are losing out in terms of not being able to sell that milk. Also very important to say that they're also making sure that raw, unpasteurised milk is not being allowed into the human food chain. It's important to say that also for chicken producers in the US, they have had a series of avian influenza outbreaks over the years that really has hit the industry very hard. The virus has evolved. It's now adapted and able to infect and cause serious illness and death in a wider range of species.
Will this be setting off any alarm bells from organisations that monitor and are concerned about food security? Do you think this will be prompting any sort of emergency response plans to be enacted?
Absolutely. And in fact, this new clade, as I mentioned, it was noted in 2020, and the international organisations, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and the World Organization for Animal Health, have been tracking this virus, and they have already commenced a process of developing a revised global strategy for the prevention and control of highly pathogenic avian influenza. That draft strategy is out for external review right now, and they hope to submit it to the General Assembly of the World Organization for Animal Health in May for ratification. And it specifically is developed to try and address this new strain of the virus that's emerged, and also to help us be better prepared for any new strains that emerge.
Should we expect any sort of major changes to biosecurity strategies or on-farm advice around biosecurity management?
I think the biosecurity advice won't change. It will be, I think, really one of the key things that's coming out of this is that it's not just the focus on this virus, but it's seeing the virus as a symptom of a deeper problem. So what we see is that this virus is really taking advantage of these very intense industries where we have large numbers of animals that are very genetically similar. So once you've got a virus that can get in and replicate in certain types and, you know, genetic strains, when you've got a whole herd or you've got a whole flock that are genetically almost identical, it loves it. So we do have to think about how we're managing our production systems. And in terms of biosecurity, generally farmers know what they need to do. The problem will be that if their farm gate prices for their products are challenging, or if the price of the inputs that they need to be able to feed their animals go up, farmers have to manage that. So we do need, and this is where a policy environment and a sort of transparent value chain is really important. We need to be sure that farmers have the resources they need to be able to manage the herds and their flocks the way that they'd like to, and not to risk not being able to feed or educate their own families. So these are big discussions that need to be had globally, not just in Australia, not just in the US, but thinking about what are safe, sustainable animal production systems that provide those essential nutrients for the human diet.
There are some vaccines available for poultry, as I understand it. Has there been any research or any development in vaccines for other livestock?
As far as I know, there has not been research on looking at influenza vaccines in cattle. This is a very rare occurrence. There are some historical reports of other types of influenza being reported in cattle, but they were self-limiting and petered out. So as far as I know, no vaccines for cattle. And the other tricky thing with influenza, just as with influenza in people, you have to keep updating the vaccine. So you can't just produce a vaccine and hope that everything's going to go well. You have to keep tracking the circulating virus and update your vaccine, as we're having to do with the COVID-19 vaccines.
And that was Robin Alders, Honorary Professor at the Australian National University. And before we go to the news headlines today, a bit of light relief with the song Geronimo by Brisbane band Shepherd.
Can you feel it? Now it's coming back. We can steal it. If we bridge this gap, I can see you through the curtains of the waterfall. When I lost it, yeah, you held my hand, but I tossed it. Didn't understand you were waiting as I dove into the waterfall. So say Geronimo. toy, all lost and gone.
Like the curtains of your wall.
So it's here I stand as a broken man, but I found my friend.
Like the curtains of your wall.
Now I'm falling down through the crashing sound. Then you come around.
Like the curtains of your wall.
And you rush to me and it sets us free. So I fall to my knees.
Like the curtains of your wall.
So say.
A change of pace there. Geronimo from the band Shepherd, a Brisbane band, when they debuted in July 2014. It's time now for the news headlines with Michael Dalla Fontana.
Thanks, Fiona. An independent review has found the National Disability Insurance Scheme's Quality and Safeguards Commission knew about problems at a service for at least 18 months but failed to shut it down. Shocking footage exposed by the ABC showed how workers at Irrabeena Autism Services in Melbourne pinned children with disabilities to the ground face down. Labor MP Dean Winter has been elected unopposed to be the party's new leader. The former Kingborough Mayor entered Parliament in 2021 and was Labor's energy spokesperson in the last Parliament. He replaces Rebecca White, who announced she would not recontest the position following her third straight election loss, but will stay in the Parliament. Anita Dow will continue as deputy leader. And the Tasmanian Health Department's urging people to prepare for expected increases in respiratory infections with the colder weather approaching and to get on top of vaccinations. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Michael. Time now to cross to the Weather Bureau and good afternoon.
Hi, how are you, Fiona?
Very good, thank you. Now, can you tell me, was there much rainfall overnight?
Look, we had a little bit about the west of the state, and really that's where the bulk of the rainfall was. In sort of agricultural areas, about 0.6 of a millimetre up in the northwest at Smithton, a little bit at Yola, 0.4 of a millimetre, but generally the rainfall was confined to.
Oh, you've broken up there. Are you back? We've got you back.
Yes.
We had a big space. We might go straight to the outlook.
And what we've got coming up, we've got a high pressure system just sitting over the to the south of Western Australia, just providing a southwesterly flow over Tasmania. We've got showers about the west and the far south of Tasmania. We will see a cold front push up from the southwest and just brush the south of Tasmania overnight, and that will extend showers more generally about the south of the state, in particular down around the southeast near Sorel, and just inland of Sorel we'll expect to see a couple of millimetres of showers overnight tonight, but showers also pushing into the Huon and the Channel but not pushing really that much further into the south of the state. And then into tomorrow, we'll see the showers quickly ease back and tend more about the west and the far south through the remainder of tomorrow, with just a chance of some light afternoon showers developing about the northeast. And the southwesterly stream will continue into Friday. We'll see some scattered showers about the west and far south, and just some possibility of some isolated early morning showers about the Over the weekend, just a high pressure system moving to the north of Tasmania. Most of the shower activity will be about the west of the state, very little elsewhere.
Any warnings?
In terms of warnings, we have strong wind warnings that are current for northern coastal waters between Sandy Cape and the northern tip of Flinders Island, and for eastern and southern coastal waters from Wineglass Bay to Low Rocky Point. In terms of the winds, we've got west to southwesterly winds, which are mostly 20 to 30 knots about northern, western, southern and lower eastern waters at the moment, easing to 15 to 25 knots in the evening. And the winds about the northeast are generally southwesterly 10 to 15 knots, although tending south to southwesterly at 10 to 20 knots about the upper east coast in the evening. We will see the winds into tomorrow just ease back. We'll go more south to southwesterly at around 10 through the course of tomorrow as that ridge of high pressure approaches. With the swells, we've got quite a big swell building around the west and south of the state. So sort of southwesterly at the moment of around 4 metres, but building up to 5 to 6 metres during today.
I think we're going to have to end it there. We're having a few problems with the Weather Bureau Cross. I think we got most of it, but a couple of spaces in the line, so I apologise for that. We'll get on with the Country Hour.
Deep in the Sahara, the male penguin does some kind of dance or whatever.
One note, it's not a penguin.
Who cares? The Johnson family is unsubscribing from the streaming service we're on. It's getting too expensive.
But how are they going to watch riveting documentaries?
ABC iView. They have docos, comedies, dramas, Bluey, and it's free. Free, like this eagle.
Not an eagle.
ABC iView. Always free, always entertaining.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour. You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, have you ever tried a farm stay, perhaps a wine or cheese tasting? 7 out of 10 visitors to Tasmania are seeking out an agritourism experience, so it's a growing market. Alison Clark has been helping operators build more resilient businesses through the Accelerator program.
So the Accelerator program is for agritourism operators who have started an agritourism activity or have been involved in an activity for some time. That could be everything from a farm accommodation with a farm kitchen through to somebody that is looking to establish agritourism activities or tours for people with disabilities, which we actually have got in this group. Some of them have got different plans that they've already had in place, marketing plans or business plans that they might have had a look at about 3 or 4 years ago. This is a real opportunity for them to have a look at, you know, what is impacting on them now. And some of the things that we're finding are resets of their financial perspective coming out of COVID and where their market and different dynamics are moving towards. Having a really good hard look at some of the things that might be coming in from their farm business, which could be of a sustainability focus, and particularly this year around, you know, water resources and things like that. But really honing in on the agritourism activity itself. So having a look at pricing, understanding a little bit more about the impact of pricing, how you can make that attractive for visitors and really set yourself into a landscape where you can actually make money from what you're doing is what we're really resetting some of those business essentials around. And then as they explore risk and business continuity, it's a little bit more about some of the natural disaster impacts that might emerge over time, which in the Australian landscape are becoming more frequent. And that's things like bushfire and flooding. And it's a little bit around if those impacts did happen to you, then what are the first things that you need to do within the first 48 hours? And then how do you pick up your business and then start to continue that over the next week to 2 weeks to the months afterwards? So those are the sorts of things we're working with them on.
But there's also a lot of regulatory reforms that need to be resolved before you can even look at setting up an agritourism experience or operation. Is that a big wad of red tape that is just a huge roadblock for a lot of people.
Oh, it is. Many operators that we work with have got hard stories to tell. Depending on the type of activity that you want to do, you could be in a space where you might have to obtain up to 18 different permits just to get your agritourism activity, product or experience, bring it to life. And that requires you to deal with up to 14 different government agencies. Local government itself, in their own areas, they're having to manage local interpretation of the planning regulations that we have. And so a lot of the operators that we work with are experiencing a really difficult pathway that can take an extended period of time and a lot of money just to get to a point where they can open the door. About late in 22 in New South Wales, they went through some planning reform that makes it a lot easier for a farmer to diversify into agritourism. It enables them to use their land for agritourism to complement their existing businesses without the need for a development application. But the farmers are still required to demonstrate that they've got a commercial farm, and the agribusiness activity must be secondary to the primary production use of that land. And we run the risk here in Tasmania of falling behind other states like New South Wales, because they've really kicked on with planning reform and made it easy for people to, including local council, to be able to get the guidance that they need, and for farmers to understand where their activities require a development application and where they don't. So it's a lot easier for a state like New South Wales, and I think ACT is underway as well, and they could just run ahead of Tasmania if we don't get reform underway here.
Well, do you think we have the right political climate to negotiate for change?
Well, that's an interesting one. I think for operators across Tasmania, we are in a landscape where agritourism sits in between agriculture and tourism, but it also reaches deep into regional communities. So it has the potential where we can bring it to life and continue to accelerate it, really have visitors exploring deep into regions and staying in regions for longer. For those of us that have been working in agritourism and working with farmers for a long time, we're starting to get the belief that agritourism is Tasmania. That's what we're all about. And the quicker that we can get these reforms underway, we can really unlock some really nice regional development happening in an agritourism landscape, which we think there's a lot of potential for.
And that was Alison Clark from Optimum Standard chatting there to Larissa Smith. Now, during COVID, Ina Antzman and Tim Noonan pivoted their truffle farm at Lower Barrington to more of a restaurant aimed at locals, which had its own charms for a while, but left them feeling burnt out and not doing what they had set out to do. They'd now gone through the Ag Accelerator program, which they say has helped them get back to doing what they love and creating unique memories and experiences.
So we purchased the farm in 2019, so 5 years ago, and basically set up the business, the truffle door, and we sort of set up the business idea. But neither one of us, neither myself or my partner, had any real background in, you know, running, operating a business or any of that sort of side of things.
Flying blind.
So, yeah, very much flying blind. It was very much a lifestyle change for us and something brand new that we'd never done before. And this program came up, which was the Opening the Gate program last year, and that sounded right up our alley. As we sort of, our farm was already set up as an agritourism business, so it is a production farm. We do produce truffles, but we do focus quite heavily on the tourist experience. So we just wanted a little bit of guidance and advice.
How do you? I mean, you're in an area where there's a lot of farm stays on offer, lots of paddock to plate kind of experiences. How have you developed your point of difference?
In terms of, you know, how have we differentiated ourselves from some of the other truffle farms around, of which there are a couple, we're a lot more boutique. The other truffle farms are much larger, more sort of production farm size. We're a lot more boutique, more intimate. So we offer quite authentic experiences that are all small group experiences. You know, you're not going to be with a busload of 40 people wandering around a farm. It's all going to be very intimate, you know, small groups, very authentic.
You might have had an advantage here in that you took on something that was already a sort of agritourism thing, but did you have to go through a council process at all, approvals, permits? Because that, I mean, we've heard from a lot of agritourist people that it's a headache, all of that.
Yeah, it certainly can be. We were quite lucky that the previous owner to us had basically gone through most of that paperwork business. So most of it was already established. It was more a matter of, you know, transferring licenses and things like that to us. So we've done a couple of extensions, but we've actually found our council, the Kentish Council, to be very helpful with everything that we've done.
Now, there's something you don't hear every day.
Yeah, no, they've actually been great, and you know, we've mostly had to deal with the like the food safety people and that sort of stuff in terms of getting commercial kitchens approved and that kind of side of things. And we've found they've always been, you know, more helpful and, you know, offering guidance and making sure that we succeed rather than trying to trip us up or anything like that. So we've certainly had a good experience with our council.
What have been the biggest challenges of this process?
From a business perspective would be trying to find the balance of creating an offering that is what people want, but also at the same time something that works towards what you actually want to do. As an example, for a while there during COVID, when COVID hit, we started operating as a cafe. Then we started offering lunch on a weekend with the idea of basically bringing the locals in because we weren't going to have any tourists for a while. And it was super popular. It certainly brought the people in, but it just got to a point where it was just too much for the two of us. And, you know, it wasn't what we originally set out to do. Rose, who runs that program, she's such an amazing person that you can just ground truth at these sorts of things with. You know, she just looked at us and went, why are you doing it? It's not giving you joy. It's not what you want to do. It's killing your relationship. It's killing you. Why are you doing this? And we were like, because people want it. But it's, yeah. I think the nice thing is when you run a small business like ours, where, you know, it's just us, we don't have a responsibility to look after 60 employees or anything like that. The nice thing with that is that we can be quite flexible.
Are you making money?
Good question. Yeah, look, it's paying the bills. We've been here for 5 years, and we're certainly still at a point where we're actually still investing quite a lot in the business. We've made quite a lot of changes. You know, we've bought big machinery and done other things. And the funny thing is, when you're a truffle farmer, you know, you get a lot of people that come in and go, "Oh, well, you grow truffles, you must be a millionaire," you know, because we all have this idea that truffles are these hugely expensive things. But the thing is, you know, if I was paying myself an hourly wage, it wouldn't be much money left after that, I think. Yeah. So it's very labour intensive. The nice thing is, if you come down for an experience like a truffle hunt, for example, when we do our truffle hunts on Saturdays in wintertime, that's a full 4-hour experience where you actually get to come out into the farm with the dogs and me, and you see how we actually find the truffles, how we dig them up. You know, you can get your hands dirty and try and dig one up yourself if you want. So you get a real feel for, you know, what it takes to actually harvest those truffles. But then you come back and you have a big 4-course truffle lunch afterwards, which is full of fresh truffle. And we don't skimp on the truffle for those. We lavish it with all the fresh truffle. So you get to enjoy a beautiful meal with it, but I think you come away with more of an appreciation for, you know, all of the work that goes into, you know, farming and harvesting these things. But then, you know, what makes them so special as well in terms of tasting them and smelling them and enjoying them.
Meg Power with that report. Now, Emma Horswell run her Pick Your Flower business in snug southern Tasmania for a couple of years now. And according to her, the secret to Earthenry Farm's growing visitors is nothing mystical. And while the dryness across the whole state has been a major burden and stress for farmers, Emma told our reporter Meg Whitfield that the flowers have had their challenges too, but she's focusing on saving the seeds from the dahlias.
we're just trying things and seeing how it goes. Yeah. And of course, the more popular our summer season is, the more spare money that we have to carry us through into the winter season. So I think it's just we're still in that trial and error stage. We haven't worked that out, but we are throwing everything at working it out at the moment.
You've also recently built a new structure on the farm, or you're doing it up?
Yeah, we've got a hay shed that's converted into a studio space. So we're hoping that that will be another sort of all-weather space that we can run workshops in winter, where we normally have an open-sided, beautiful old tractor shed that we run our workshops from. But now we've got four walls and heating and lights and things. So that does open up our opportunities to have workshops in winter, and also a retail space perhaps down the line.
Who is it who is typically coming along to these days and coming along to the farm?
Yeah, it's actually all ages. We do a little bit of thinking about this at the end of the season and making sure we're catering for our different sort of groups of people that are coming through. But yeah, from the 20-somethings in that age bracket right the way through to people who are bringing their grandparents through, and they're just, everyone's connecting with the flowers. Children love the space. They love exploring it. And I mean, we are really lucky in that regards. We have a very open age range of people that can enjoy our product, I guess, our farm.
What do you think it is that makes this such an appealing place for people to come, or what do you think it is that's driven this increase in demand?
I mean, it's just nature, isn't it? Like, it's not it's not anything anything mystical. It's just really enjoyable to be around beauty and in nature, and you can't beat a flower farm growing a diverse range of flowers for interest and colour and texture and then just all the beauty of the surrounds that are in the farm that we try and create, all the borders that grow around the actual flower fields. You know, we try and create a really beautiful, immersive place that people can come and escape, and you just leave your worries behind. It's also a creative experience as well. So rather than dictating you can have these flowers in this bunch of flowers that I've picked for you, we're saying here's a picture, here's some snips, head out into the fields and just be creative and choose what you love. And I think that's the secret to our success.
What about the dry conditions that all of Tasmania has faced over summer? What kind of influence has that had on the growth of the flowers and also just future planning?
Yeah, irrigation's always a big thing, and we're expanding our fields, so we are really thinking about our water supply. We did max out on our current water supply. We've got wonderful neighbours who have a huge dam that have allowed us to access that, but we will have to look at strategies such as continuing with the drip irrigation that we're doing. So each season we are drip irrigating, which means that we've actually been able to halve our sort of irrigation from the start when we first started, when we're just watering in time blocks. So now we water in tiny small sections across the day, which is called pulse irrigation. And so that has managed us to cut our water in by 50%. Pretty much, which is incredible. So down from 1 hour to half an hour for each bed across the day. So that was a huge saver, and that has really helped us. So we haven't had any issues with the dry weather because of that. That being said, we're at the very end of the season. We have run out of water. So, next season when we're doubling our output of flowers and our flower-growing area, we do have to make sure that we're not wasting water anywhere. And yeah, if it is going to be another hot season or a dry season, we'll be calling our neighbours and being especially nice.
Is there anything else do you think is important to get across or you'd like to say?
No, I mean, just the season at the moment, it's in the garden, it's time to save seeds. So for everyone who's listening, who's got their dahlias in the ground, and you know, go head out into the garden and save some seeds, because that will be a great resource for you in spring when you're thinking about planting again.
Emma Horsfall there. Time now for the Livestock Report and Richard Bailey. Good afternoon.
Hello, Fiona. How are you going?
Very good, thank you. Now, how are the cattle markets going?
Okay, yesterday at Piranha, 148 trade and grown cattle, which is 90 more than last week. Market was a little bit better. After the rains, a bit more restocker competition and a bit more butcher competition. I thought most of those sort of cattle were anywhere from 10 to 20 cents dearer. Most yearling steers made 200 to 244 cents and heifers 208 to 272. There weren't any, well, not enough grown steers and bullocks to quote. There were 75 cows. The best heavy cows improved on average by about 15 cents a kilo, which meant that the heavy cows made 160 to a top of 193 cents. It's a while since we've seen that. Leaner cows 128 to 156 and lean cows down to 20 cents, but mainly 80 to 100 cents. Some good heavy bulls made 134 to 150 cents a kilo. On cattle, we've got a weaner sale next Thursday, not tomorrow, but the following Thursday, 12 o'clock start, over 3,000 cattle.
Okay, sheep and lamb.
Okay, over in the lamb yard, quite a few more lambs and a few better quality lambs, still not much weight, but just a few more better lambs. And these sort of showed improvement of anywhere from $10 to $20 a head, I reckon, across the board. The best trade lambs made $118 to a top of $154. Light trade, $78 to $115. And lighter than that, $60 to $70 are MK lambs. Restockers, they bought lambs, very small lambs down to $5 to $20 and then the middle range $30 to $76 and light trade $78 to $91. There was a yarding of 600 at mutton and most of these sheep showed further improvement on last week's better sale. The extra heavy sheep made $60 to $68, heavy $50 to $72, medium weights $30 to $53 and light sheep $20 to $30 a head. Oatlands tomorrow, 11 o'clock start, repeat, 11 o'clock start. There'll be just shy of 5,000 sheep there. Good place to go to buy a few extra sheep.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, Richard Bailey.
Good on you, Fiona.
Now it's time to go to Joel. Good afternoon, Joel.
Hello there, Fiona. How are you doing?
Very good.
We've got a really interesting talk topic today, which is hate at first sight.
Hate at first sight.
Have you ever had someone, now, no names, no pack drill. We don't want to defame anyone today. No libel suits, please. But is there anyone that you've ever met, besides me, obviously, who you've just instantly disliked, instantly gone, oh, something about them gives me the ick?
Yeah, probably. Probably a mansplainer of some sort.
If the first time you meet someone and they're doing something like that, yeah, completely understand it. So I can think of a couple of them, colleagues I've had over the years.
Even more than that, one of them I just thought,
oh, you know, there's something about you I really don't like. But then gradually realised that there was nothing actually wrong with her and that she was fine. And
yeah, I have done that as well.
She reminded me of someone who was nasty. She just had some similar mannerisms to someone and voice to someone who was previously a nasty person. And I was like, oh, I can't blame her for my past and got over it. But then there's another one who, you know, another colleague who I instantly had the ick and was proven correct. They were a psychopath and a bully and just awful to everyone. I was like, yeah, I saw through your smarmy smile the first time I met you.
Yes.
And indeed, it turned out to be true. I was right. So we always talk about love at first sight. I mean, there's songs, so many songs about love. And movies, Romeo and Juliet is essentially a love at first sight story between, well, what are they? They're only meant to be like 16 and 13, I think, Romeo and Juliet, something like that.
Yes.
But love at first sight. So we're going to talk about hate at first sight.
Well, yeah, on that, like I have, you know, met someone and thought, oh, God, you're a real pain.
And
then I realised actually they're quite nice and, oh, you're a horrible person, Fiona. But you can't judge a book by its cover.
I wonder how many people have ended up married to that person.
Yeah, possibly.
You know, another Hollywood trope. Oh, I hate him. He's terrible. And then, you know, you find yourself, you know, thinking of them and then smooching them later on. So, we're going to talk with our psychologist, our regular psychologist, about hate at first sight. I know that she doesn't like the word hate. She said, you know, hate is a specific thing and it's got to last for a long time. But
I think my parents used to say something like, that's a bit strong. Or
Yeah, we don't use that word.
We don't use that word in this house.
Yeah, you know.
I don't like it.
Yeah, look, you know, that said, there are a couple of people in my entire 53-year lifespan who I look back and go, yeah, I hated them and I still hate them. Just a couple.
That big bully. But they,
exactly. But bad bullying is generally the big thing. You know, that deep unkindness is the thing that cuts me the most. When we're also going to have live music from Harry Manx, who plays kind of this Indian-influenced blues. He's fabulous. Fabulous Canadian blues man. We'll meet him too.
Fantastic, Joel Reinberger. And I'll catch you again on the Country Hour tomorrow.
Subscribe to the ABC Radio Hobart e-newsletter today. You'll get exclusive content, a first peek at the latest competitions and program highlight delivered straight to your inbox.
Now we're talking Hobart.
To subscribe, head to abc.net.au/Hobart.